20 miles away, Childermas was crossing over the packhorse bridge that led into Staircross Village. He rode through the village to the hall and dismounted. "Hey! Hey!" He banged on the door with his whip. He shouted some more and gave the door a few vigorous kicks. 2 servants appeared. They'd been alarmed enough by all the shouting and banging, but when they held up their candle and found that its author was a wild-eyed, cutthroat-looking person with a slit in his face and his shirt all bloody, they were not in the least reassured. "Do not stand there gawping," he told them. "Go fetch Master. He knows me." 10 minutes more brought Mr. Secundus in a dressing gown, Childermas waiting impatiently just within the door. Saw that as he came along the passage, his eyes were closed, and the servant led him by the hand. It looked for all the world as if he had gone blind. The servant placed him just before Childermas. He opened his eyes.
"Good Lord, Mr. Childermas," he cried. "What happened to your face?"
"Someone mistook it for an orange. And you, sir, what has happened to you? Have you been ill?"
No, not ill." Mr. Secundus looked embarrassed. "It is living in constant proximity to strong magic. I had not realized before how weakening that can be. To a person who is susceptible to it, I mean. The servants feel no effects whatsoever, I'm glad to say."
There was a queer insubstantiality about him. He looked as if he were painted on the air. The merest draught from a gap in the casement took his hair and made little corkscrews and curlicues of it, as if it weighed nothing at all.
"I suppose that is what you've come about," he continued. "But you should tell Mr. Norrell that I've done nothing but study the occurrences that presented themselves. I confess I have made a few notes, but really he has nothing to complain about."
"What magic?" asked Childermas. "What are you talking about? And you need not concern yourself any longer about Mr. Norrell. He has problems of his own, and knows nothing of my being here. What have you been doing, Mr. Secundus?"
"Only watching and recording, as a magician should."
Mr. Secundus leant forward eagerly.
"And I've come to some surprising conclusions concerning Lady Pole's illness."
"Oh?"
"In my opinion, it is not madness at all. It's magic."
Mr. Secundus waited for Childermas to be amazed. He looked a little disappointed when Childermas simply nodded.
"I have something that belongs to her ladyship," said Childermas. "Something she has long missed, so I beg that you will do me the kindness of taking me to her."
"Oh, but
I mean her no harm, Mr. Secundus, and I believe I may be able to do her some good. I swear it. By bird and book. By bird and book."
Footnote 1. This is an old Northern English oath. John Usklas's arms showed a raven in flight upon a white field. Argent, raven, volant. Those of his chancellor, William Lanchester, showed the same with the addition of an open book. Argent, raven volant, above an open book. For much of the 13th century, John Usklas devoted himself to scholarship and magic, abandoning the business of government to Lanchester. Lanchester's arms were displayed in all the great courts of law and upon many important legal documents. Consequently, the people fell into the habit of swearing by bird and book, the elements of those arms.
"I cannot take you to her," said Mr. Secundus.
He put up his hand to forestall Childermas's objection.
"I do not mean that I am unwilling. I mean I cannot. Charles will take us."
He indicated the servant at his side. This seemed rather eccentric, but Childermas was in no mood to argue about it. Mr. Secundus grasped Charles's arm and closed his eyes. Behind the stone and oak passages of Staircross Hall, a vision of another house leapt up. Childermas saw high corridors that stretched away into unthinkable distances. It was as if 2 transparencies had been put into a magic lantern at the same time, so that one picture overlaid the other. The impression of walking through both houses at once rapidly brought on a sensation akin to seasickness. Confusion mounted in his mind, and, had he been alone, he would soon have been at a loss to know which way to go. He could not tell whether he was walking or falling, whether he climbed 1 step or mounted a staircase of impossible length. Sometimes he seemed to be skimming across an acre of stone flags, while at the same time he was scarcely moving at all. His head spun, and he felt sick.
"Stop! Stop!" he cried, and sank to the ground with his eyes closed.
"It affects you badly," said Mr. Secundus. "Worse even than me. Close your eyes and take hold of my arm. Charles will lead us both."
They walked on, eyes closed. Charles guided them around a right-hand turning and up a staircase. At the top of the staircase, there was a murmured conversation between Mr. Segundus and someone. Charles drew Childermas forward. Childermas had the impression of entering a room. It smelt of clean linen and dried roses.
"This is the person you wish me to see?" said a woman's voice.
There was something odd about it, as if it were coming from two places at once, as if there were an echo.
"But I know this person. He is the magician's servant. He is—"
"I am the person your ladyship shot," said Childermas, and he opened his eyes.
He saw not one woman, but two. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say he saw the same woman doubled. Both sat in the same posture, looking up at him. They occupied the same space, so that he had the same giddy feeling in looking at her as he had walking through the corridors. One version of Lady Pole sat in the house in Yorkshire. She wore an ivory-coloured morning dress and regarded him with calm indifference. The other version was fainter, more ghostly. She sat in the gloomy, labyrinthine house, dressed in a blood-red evening gown. There were jewels or stars in her dark hair, and she regarded him with fury and hatred. Mr. Segundus pulled Childermas to the right.
"Stand just here," he said excitedly. "Now, close one eye. Can you see it? Observe. A red and white rose where her mouth ought to be."
"The magic affects us differently," said Childermas. "I see something very strange, but I do not see that."
"You are very bold to come here,"
said both versions of Lady Pole, addressing Childermas,
"considering who you are and whom you represent."
"I'm not here on Mr. Norrell's business. To own the truth, I'm not entirely sure who it is I represent. I think it is Jonathan Strange. It is my belief that he sent me a message, and I think it was about your ladyship. But the messenger was prevented from reaching me, and the message was lost. Do you know, your ladyship, what Mr. Strange might have wished to tell me about you?"
"Yes,"
said both versions of Lady Pole.
"Will you tell me what it is?"
"If I speak," they said, "I shall speak nothing but madness."
Childermas shrugged his shoulders.
"I've passed 20 years in the Society of Magicians. I'm accustomed to it. Speak."
So she, or they, began. Immediately, Mr. Segundus took a memorandum book out of a pocket of his nightgown and began to scribble notes. But in Childermas's eyes, the two versions of Lady Pole were no longer speaking as one. The Lady Pole who sat in Staircross Hall told a tale about a child who lived near Carlisle. Footnote 2. One autumn morning, the Cumbrian child went out into her grandmother's garden. In a forgotten corner, she discovered a house about the height and largeness of a beeskep, built of spiders' webs stiffened and whitened with hoarfrost. Inside the lacy house was a tiny person, who at times appeared immeasurably old, and at other times no older than the child herself. The little person told the Cumbrian child that she was a songbird herd, and that for ages past it had been her task to watch over the field fares, redwings, and missel thrushes in that part of Cumbria. All winter the Cumbrian child and the songbird herd played together, and the progress of their friendship was not in the least impeded by the difference in their sizes. In fact, the songbird herd generally did away with this obstacle by making herself as large as the Cumbrian child, or sometimes by making them both as small as birds or beetles or snowflakes. The songbird herd introduced the Cumbrian child to many odd and interesting persons, some of whom lived in houses even more eccentric and delightful than the songbird herd's own. But the woman in the blood-red gown seemed to be telling quite a different story. She wore a fierce expression and emphasized her words with passionate gestures, but what she said, Childermas could not tell. The whimsical tale of the Cumbrian child drowned it out.
"There, you see,"
exclaimed Mr. Segundus, as he finished scribbling his notes. "This is what makes them think her mad, these odd stories and tales. But I have made a list of all that she's told me, and I've begun to find correspondences between them and ancient fairy lore. I'm sure that if you and I were to make inquiries, we would discover some reference to a set of fairies who had some close connection with songbirds. They may not have been songbird herds. That, you will agree, sounds a little too much like settled occupation for such a feckless race. But they may have pursued a particular sort of magic related to songbirds, and it may have suited one of their number to tell an impressionable child that she was a songbird herd. Perhaps, said Childermas, not much interested. But that was not what she meant to tell us. And I have remembered the magical significance of roses. They stand for silence. That's why you see a red and white rose. It is a muffling spell.
A muffling spell? Said Mr. Segundus in amazement. Yes, yes, I see that. I've read about such things, but how do we break it?
From his coat pocket, Childermas took a little box, the colour of heartache. Your ladyship, he said, give me your left hand. She laid her white hand in Childermas's lined brown one. Childermas opened the box, took out the finger, and laid it against the empty place. Nothing happened.
We must find Mr. Strange, said Mr. Segundus, or Mr. Norrell. They may be able to mend it.
No, said Childermas. There's no need. Not now. You and I are two magicians, Mr. Segundus, and England is full of magic. How many years' study do we have between us? We must know something to the point. What about Pale's restoration and rectification?
I know the form of it, said Mr. Segundus, but I've never been a practical magician.
And you never will be, if you do not try. Do the magic, Mr. Segundus. So Mr. Segundus did the magic. Footnote 3. Like most of Martin Pale's magic, restoration and rectification involves the use of a tool or key made specifically for the purpose. In this case, the key is a small cross-like object made of two thin pieces of metal. The four arms of the cross represent past state and future state, wholeness or wellness, and incompleteness or sickness. As he later reported in The Modern Magician, Mr. Segundus used a spoon and a bodkin from Lady Pole's dressing case, which Lady Pole's maid tied together with a ribbon. The finger flowed into the hand, making a seamless hole. In the same instant, the impression of endless, dreary corridors surrounding them disappeared. The two women before Childermas's eyes resolved themselves into one. Lady Pole rose slowly from her chair. Her eyes went rapidly this way and that, like someone who is seeing the world anew. Everyone in the room could see she was changed. There was animation and fire in every feature. Her eyes glowed with a furious light. She raised both arms, her hands were clenched in tight fists, as if she intended to bring them down upon someone's head.
I've been enchanted, she burst out, bargained away for the sake of a wicked man's career.
Good God, cried Mr. Segundus. My dear Lady Pole.
Compose yourself, Mr. Segundus, said Childermas. We have no time for trivialities. Let us speak.
I have been dead within and almost dead without.
Tears started from her eyes, and she struck her own breast with her clenched hand.
And not only me, others suffer even now. Mrs. Strange, and my husband's servant, Stephen Black.
She recounted the cold, ghostly balls she had endured, the dreary processions she had been forced to take part in, and the strange handicap that would not allow her and Stephen Black to speak of their predicament. Mr. Segundus and the servants heard each new revelation with mounting horror. Childermas sat and listened with impassive expression.
We must write to the editors of the newspapers, cried Lady Pole. I am determined upon public exposure.
Exposure of whom? Asked Mr. Segundus.
The magicians, of course. Strange and Norrell.
Mr. Strange? Faltered Mr. Segundus.
Oh, no, 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 you are mistaken. My dear Lady Pole, take a moment to consider what you're saying. I have not a word to say for Mr. Norrell. His crimes against you are monstrous. But Mr. Strange has done no harm, not knowingly at any rate. Surely he is more sinned against than sinning. Oh, cried Lady Pole, upon the contrary. I consider him by far the worst of the two. By his negligence and cold masculine magic, he has betrayed the best of women, the most excellent of wives.
Childermas stood up.
Where are you going? Asked Mr. Segundus.
To find Strange and Norrell, said Childermas.
Why? Cried Lady Pole, rounding on him. To warn them? So that they can prepare themselves against a woman's vengeance? Oh, how these men protect one another.
No. I'm going to offer them my assistance to free Mrs. Strange and Stephen Black. Lascelles walked on. The path entered a wood. At the entrance to the wood was the statue of a woman holding the plucked iron heart, just as Childermas had described. Corpses hung from the thorn trees in various states of decay. Snow lay on the ground, and it was very quiet. After a while, he came to the tower. He had imagined it to be a fanciful, otherlandish sort of place. But really, he thought, it's very plain, like the castles of the Scottish border country. High in the tower was a single window glowing with candlelight, and the shadow of someone watching. Lascelles noticed something else, too, something that Childermas had either not seen or else had not troubled to report. The trees were full of serpent-like creatures. They had heavy, sagging forms. One was in the process of swallowing whole a fresh, meaty-looking corpse. Between the trees and the brook was the pale young man. His eyes were empty, and there was a slight dew upon his brow. His uniform was, thought Lascelles, that of the 11th Light Dragoons. Lascelles addressed him thus. One of our countrymen approached you a few days ago. He spoke to you. You challenged him. Then he ran away. He was a dark, ill-favored fellow, person of despicable habits and base origins. If the pale young man recognized Childermas from this description, he showed no sign of it. In a dead voice, he said, I am the champion of the castle of the plucked eye and heart. I offer challenges to— Yes, yes, cried Lascelles impatiently. I do not care about that. I've come here to fight, to erase the stain upon England's honor that was made by that fellow's cowardice. The figure at the window leaned forward eagerly. The pale young man said nothing. Lascelles made a sound of exasperation. Very well. Believe that I mean this woman all sorts of harm, if it pleases you. It matters not a whit to me. Pistols? The pale young man shrugged. There being no seconds to act for them, Lascelles told the young man that they would stand at 20 paces, and he measured the ground himself. They had taken their positions and were about to fire when something occurred to Lascelles. Wait, he cried. What is your name? The young man stared dully at him. I do not remember, he said. They both fired their pistols at the same time. Lascelles had the impression that at the last moment the young man turned his pistol and deliberately fired wide. Lascelles did not care. If the young man was a coward, then so much the worse for him. His own ball flew with pleasing exactitude to pierce the young man's breast. He watched him die with the same intense interest and sense of satisfaction that he had felt when he had killed Drawlight. He hung the body upon the nearest thorn tree. Then he amused himself by taking shots at the decaying bodies and the serpents. He had not been engaged in this pleasant occupation for more than an hour when he heard the sounds of hooves upon the woodland path. From the opposite direction, from Faery rather than England, a dark figure upon a dark horse was approaching. Lascelles spun round. I am the champion of the castle of the plucked eye and heart, he began. Chapter 65. The Ashes, the Pearls, the Counterpane, and the Kiss. Mid-February, 1817. As Lucas and the others were leaving Hertfew Abbey, Stephen was dressing in his bedchamber at the top of the house in Harley Street. London is a city with more than its fair share of eccentricities, but of all the surprising places it contained at this time, the most extraordinary was undoubtedly Stephen's bedchamber. It was full of things that were precious, rare, or wonderful. If the cabinet or the gentleman who directed the Bank of England had been somehow able to acquire the contents of Stephen's bedchamber, their cares would have all been over. They could have paid off Britain's debts and built London anew with the change. Thanks to the gentleman with the thistledown hair, Stephen possessed crown jewels from who knew what kingdoms, and embroidered robes that had once belonged to Coptic popes. The flower pots upon his windowsill contained no flowers, but only ruby and pearl crosses, carved jewels, and the insignia of long-dead military orders. Inside his small cupboard was a piece of the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and the thigh bone of a Basque saint. St. Christopher's hat hung upon a peg behind the door, and a marble statue of Lorenzo de' Medici by Michelangelo, which had stood until recently upon the great man's tomb in Florence, occupied most of the floor.
Stephen was shaving himself in a little mirror balanced upon Lorenzo de Medici's knee, when the gentleman appeared at his shoulder.
"The magician has returned to England," he cried. "I saw him last night in the King's Roads, with the darkness wrapped about him like a mystical cloak. What does he want? What can he be planning? Oh, this will be the end of me, Stephen. I feel it. He means me great harm."
Stephen felt a chill. The gentleman was always at his most dangerous in this mood of agitation and alarm.
"We should kill him," said the gentleman.
"Kill him? Oh, no, sir."
"Why not? We could be rid of him forever. I could bind his arms, eyes, and tongue with magic, and you could stab him through the heart."
Stephen thought rapidly. "But his return may have nothing to do with you at all, sir," he offered. "Consider how many enemies he has in England, human enemies, I mean. Perhaps he's come back to continue his quarrel with one of them." The gentleman looked doubtful. Any reasoning that did not contain a reference to himself was always difficult for him to follow.
"I do not think that very likely," he said.
"Oh, but yes," said Stephen, beginning to feel upon surer ground. "There have been terrible things written about him in the newspapers and the magical journals. There is a rumor that he killed his wife. Many people believe it. Were it not for his present situation, he would very likely have been arrested by now. And it is common knowledge that the other magician is the author of all these lies and half-truths. Probably Strange has come to take revenge upon his master." The gentleman stared at Stephen for a moment or two. Then he laughed, his spirits as elevated as moments before they had been the reverse.
"We have nothing to fear, Stephen," he cried in delight. "The magicians have quarreled and hate each other, yet they are nothing without one another. How glad that makes me, how happy I am to have you to advise me. And it so happens that I intend to give you a wonderful present today. Something you have long desired."
"Indeed, sir," said Stephen with a sigh. "That will be most delightful."
"Yet we ought to kill someone," said the gentleman,
immediately reverting to his former subject.
"I've been quite put out of temper this morning, and someone ought to die for it. What do you say to the old magician?" Oh, but wait. That would oblige the younger one, which I do not want to do. What about Lady Pole's husband? He's tall and arrogant, and treats you like a servant."
"But I am a servant, sir."
"Or the King of England?" "Yes, that is an excellent plan. Let you and I go immediately to the King of England. Then you can put him to death and be king in his place. Do you have the orb, crown, and scepter that I gave you?"
"But the laws of Great Britain do not allow—" began Stephen.
"The laws of Great Britain? Pish tush! What nonsense! I thought you would have understood by now that the laws of Great Britain are nothing but flimsy testament to the idle wishes and dreams of mankind. According to the ancient laws by which my race conducts itself, a king is most commonly succeeded by the person who killed him."
"But, sir, remember how much you liked the old gentleman when you met him."
"Well, that's true. But in a matter of such importance, I am willing to put aside my personal feelings. The difficulty is that we have too many enemies, Stephen. There are too many wicked persons in England." "I know. I shall ask some of my allies to tell us who is our greatest enemy of all. We must be careful. We must be cunning. We must frame our question with exactitude."
Footnote 1. It is all very well in fairy tales to ask who is the fairest of them all, but in reality no magic fairy or human could ever be persuaded to answer such an imprecise question.
"I shall ask the North Wind and the Dawn to bring us immediately into the presence of the one person in England whose existence is the greatest threat to me, and then we can kill him, whoever he is. You observe, Stephen, that I make reference to my own life, but I consider your fate and mine as bound so closely together that there is scarcely any difference between us. Whosoever is a danger to me is a danger to you also. Now, take up your crown and orb and scepter, and say a last farewell to the scenes of your slavery. It may be that you shall never see them again."
"But—" began Stephen. It was too late. The gentleman raised his long white hands and gave a sort of flourish. Stephen expected to be brought before one or other of the magicians, possibly both. Instead, the gentleman and he found themselves upon a wide, empty moor covered in snow. More snow was falling. On one side, the ground rose up to meet the heavy slate-coloured sky. On the other was a misty view of faraway white hills.
In all that desolate landscape, there was only one tree, a twisted hawthorn, not far from where they stood. It was, thought Stephen, very like the country around Staircross Hall.
"Well, this is very odd," said the gentleman. "I do not see anybody at all. Do you?"
"No, sir, no one," said Stephen in relief. "Let us return to London."
"I cannot understand. Ah, but wait. Here is someone."
Half a mile or so away, there seemed to be a road or track of some sort. A horse and cart were coming slowly along it. When the cart drew level with the hawthorn tree, it stopped, and someone got out. This person began to stump across the moor towards them.
"Excellent," cried the gentleman. "Now we shall see our wickedest and most powerful enemy. Put on your crown, Stephen. Let him tremble before our power and majesty. Excellent. Raise your scepter. Yes, yes, hold forth your orb. How handsome you look. How regal. Now, Stephen, since we have a little time before he arrives..."
The gentleman gazed at the little figure in the distance, laboring across the snowy moor.
"I have something else to tell you. What is the date today?"
"The 15th of February, sir. St. Anthony's Day."
"Ah, a dreary saint indeed. Well, in future, the people of England will have something better to celebrate on the 15th of February than the life of a monk who keeps the rain off people and finds their lost thimbles."
Footnote 2. Sir Anthony of Padua. Several of his miracles involved preserving from rain congregations to whom he was preaching, or maidservants with whom he was friendly. He also helps people find things they have lost. "Well, they indeed, and what is that?"
"The naming of Stephen Black."
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"I told you, Stephen, that I would find your true name."
"What? Did my mother really name me, sir?"
"Oh, yes, indeed. It is all just as I supposed, which is scarcely surprising, since I am really wrong in such matters. She named you with a name in her own tongue, with a name she had heard often amongst her own people when she was a young girl. She named you, but she did not tell the name to a single soul. She did not even whisper it into your infant ear. She had no time, because death stole upon her and took her unawares."
A picture rose up in Stephen's mind. The dark, fusty hold of the ship. His mother, worn out by the pains of childbirth, surrounded by strangers. Himself, a tiny infant. Did she even speak the language of the other people on board? He had no way of knowing. How alone she must have felt. He would have given a great deal at that moment to be able to reach out and comfort her. But all the years of his life lay between them. He felt his heart harden another degree against the English. Only a few minutes ago, he had struggled to persuade the gentleman not to kill Strange. But why should he care what became of one Englishman? Why should he care what became of any of that cold, callous race? With a sigh, he put these thoughts aside and discovered that the gentleman was still talking.
"It is a most edifying tale, and demonstrates to perfection all those qualities for which I am especially famed. Namely, self-sacrifice, devoted friendship, nobility of purpose, perceptiveness, ingenuity, and courageousness."
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"The story of my finding your name, Stephen, which I am now going to relate. Know, then, that your mother died in the hold of a ship, the Penlaw."
Footnote 3. Penlaw is the name of the place in Northumbria where John Usklas and his fairy army first appeared in England.
"That was sailing from Jamaica to Liverpool. Then," he added in a matter-of-fact tone, "the English sailors stripped her body and flung it into the sea."
"Ah," breathed Stephen.
"Now, as you may imagine, this made the task of recovering your name extremely difficult. After 30 or 40 years, all that was left of your mother was four things. Her screams in childbirth, which had sunk into the planks of the ship. Her bones, which was all that was left of her, once the flesh and softer parts had been devoured by fishes."
"Ah," exclaimed Stephen again.
"Her gown of rose-coloured cotton, which had passed into the possession of a sailor. And a kiss, which the captain of the ship had stolen from her 2 days earlier. Now,
said the gentleman, who was clearly enjoying himself immensely.
You will observe with what cleverness and finesse I traced the passage of each part of her through the world, until I was able to recover them and so divine your glorious name. The Penlaw sailed on to Liverpool, where the wicked grandfather of Lady Pole's wicked husband disembarked with his servant, who carried your own infant person in his arms. On the Penlaw's next voyage, which was to Leith in Scotland, it met with a storm and was wrecked. Various spars and bits of broken hull were cast up upon the rocky shore, including the planks that contained your mother's screams. These were taken by a very poor man to make a roof and walls for his house. I found the house very easily. It stood upon a windy promontory overlooking a stormy sea. Inside, several generations of the poor man's family were living in the utmost poverty and degradation. Now you should know, Stephen, that wood has a stubborn, proud nature. It does not readily tell what it knows, even to its friends. It is always easier to deal with the ashes of the wood rather than wood itself. So I burnt the poor man's house to the ground, placed the ashes in a bottle, and continued on my way.
Burnt, sir? I hope no one was hurt.
Well, some people were. The strong young men were able to run out of the conflagration in time, but the older, enfeebled members of the family, the women and infants, were all burnt to death.
Oh.
Next, I traced the history of her bones. I believe I mentioned before that she was cast into the ocean, where, due to the movement of the waters and the importunate interference of the fishes, the body became bones, the bones became dust, and the dust was very soon transformed by a bed of oysters into several handfuls of the most beautiful pearls. In time, the pearls were harvested and sold to a jeweler in Paris, who created a necklace of 5 perfect strands. This he sold to a beautiful French comtesse. 7 years later, the comtesse was guillotined, and her jewels, gowns, and personal possessions became the property of a revolutionary official. This wicked man was, until quite recently, the mayor of a small town in the Loire Valley. Late at night, he would wait until all his servants had gone to bed, and then, in the privacy of his bedchamber, he would put on the comtesse's jewels and gowns and other finery, and parade up and down in front of a large mirror. Here I found him one night, looking, I may say, very ridiculous. I strangled him upon the spot, using the pearl necklace.
Oh, said Stephen.
I took the pearls, let the miserable corpse fall to the ground, and passed on. Next, I turned my attention to your mother's pretty rose-colored gown. The sailor who had acquired it kept it among his things for a year or two, until he happened to find himself in a cold, miserable little hamlet on the eastern coast of America called Piper's Grave. There he met a tall, thin woman, and wishing to impress her, he gave her the gown as a present. The gown did not fit this woman. Your mother, Stephen, had a sweetly rounded, feminine figure. But she liked the colour, and so she cut it up and sewed the pieces into a counterpane with some other cheap materials. The rest of this woman's history is not very interesting. She married several husbands and buried them all, and by the time I found her, she was old and withered. I plucked the counterpane off her bed as she slept.
You did not kill her, did you, sir? Asked Stephen anxiously.
No, Stephen. Why would I? Of course, it was a bitter night with 4 feet of snow and a raging north wind outside. She may have died of the cold. I do not know. So, we come at last to the kiss and the captain who stole it from her.
Did you kill him, sir?
No, Stephen, though I would certainly have done so to punish him for his insult to your esteemed mother. But he was hanged in the town of Valletta 29 years ago. Fortunately, he had kissed a great many other young women before he died, and the virtue and strength of your mother's kiss had been conveyed to them, so all I had to do was to find them and extract what was left of your mother's kiss.
And how did you do that, sir? Asked Stephen, though he feared that he knew the answer all too well.
Oh, it's easy enough, once the women are dead.
So many people dead, just to find my name, sighed Stephen.
And I would have gladly have killed twice that number, nay, 100 times, nay, 100,000 times or more. So great is the love I bear you, Stephen. With the ashes that were her screams, and the pearls that were her bones, and the counterpane that was her gown, and the magical essence of her kiss, I was able to divine your name, which I, your truest friend, and most noble benefactor, will now... Oh, but here is our enemy. As soon as we've killed him, I will bestow your name upon you. Beware, Stephen. There will probably be a magical combat of some sort. I dare say I shall have to take on different forms, cockatrices, raw head and bloody bones, rains of fire, etc., etc. You may wish to stand back a little.
The unknown person drew closer. He was as thin as a Banbury cheese, with a hawk-like, disreputable-looking face. His coat and shirt were in rags, and his boots were broken and full of holes.
"Well," said the gentleman after a moment, "I could not be more astonished. Have you ever seen this person before, Stephen?"
"Yes, sir. I must confess that I have. This is the man I told you about, the one with the strange disfiguration who told me the prophecy. His name is Vinculus."
"Good day to you, King," said Vinculus to Stephen. "Did I not tell you the hour has almost come? Now it has. The rain shall make a door for you, and you shall go through it. The stones shall make a throne for you, and you shall sit upon it."
He surveyed Stephen with a mysterious satisfaction, as if the crown, orb, and scepter were somehow all his doing. Stephen said to the gentleman, "Perhaps the venerable beings to whom you applied are mistaken, sir. Perhaps they have brought us to the wrong person."
"Nothing seems more likely," agreed the gentleman. "This vagabond is scarcely any threat to anyone. To me, least of all. But as the North Wind and the Dawn have taken the trouble to point him out to us, it would be most disrespectful to them not to kill him."
Vinculus seemed curiously unmoved by this proposal. He gave a laugh.
"Try if you can do it, fairy. You will discover that I'm very hard to kill."
"Are you indeed?" said the gentleman. "For I must confess that it looks to me as if nothing would be easier. But then, you see, I am very adept at killing all sorts of things. I've slain dragons, drowned armies, and persuaded the earthquakes and tempests to devour cities. You are a man. You're all alone, as all men are. I am surrounded by ancient friends and allies. Rogue, what do you have to counter that?"
Vinculus thrust out his dirty chin at the gentleman in a gesture of the utmost contempt.
"A book," he said.
It was an odd thing to say. Stephen could not help thinking that if Vinculus had indeed possessed a book, he would have been well advised to sell it and buy a better coat. The gentleman turned his head to gaze with sudden intensity at a distant line of white hills.
"Oh,"
he exclaimed, with as much violence as if he had been struck.
"Oh, they have stolen her from me! Thieves, thieves, English thieves!"
"Who, sir?"
"Lady Pole. Someone has broken the enchantment." "The magic of Englishmen, fairy," cried Vinculus. "The magic of Englishmen is coming back." "Now you see their arrogance, Stephen," cried the gentleman, spinning round to bestow a look of vivid fury upon Vinculus. "Now you see the malice of our enemies, Stephen. Procure me some rope."
"Rope, sir? There is none for miles around, I'm sure. Let you and I—"
"No rope, fairy,"
jeered Vinculus. But something was happening in the air above them. The lines of sleet and snow were somehow twisting together. They snaked across the sky towards Stephen. Without warning, a length of strong rope fell into his hand.
"There," cried the gentleman triumphantly. "Stephen, look. Here is a tree. One tree in all this desolate waste, exactly where we need it. But England has always been my friend. She has always served me well. Throw the rope over a branch. Let us hang this rogue."
Stephen hesitated, uncertain for the moment how to prevent this new disaster. The rope in his hand seemed to grow impatient with him. It jumped away and divided itself neatly into two lengths. One snaked across the ground to Vinculus and trussed him tight, and the other quickly formed itself into a well-made noose and hung itself neatly over a branch. The gentleman was in high glee, his spirits quite restored at the prospect of a hanging.
"Do you dance, rogue?" he asked Vinculus. "I shall teach you some new steps."
Everything took on the character of a nightmare. Events happened quickly and seamlessly, and Stephen never found the right moment to intervene or the right words to say. As for Vinculus himself, he behaved very oddly
throughout his entire execution. He never appeared to understand what was happening to him. He said not another word, but he did make several exclamations of exasperation, as if he was being put to some serious inconvenience, and it was putting him out of temper. Without any appearance of exertion, the gentleman took hold of Vinculus and placed him beneath the noose. The noose draped itself about his neck and hoisted him abruptly into the air. At the same time, the other rope unwound itself from his body and folded itself neatly on the ground. Vinculus kicked his feet uselessly in the empty air. His body jerked and spun. For all his boast of being hard to kill, his neck broke very easily. The snapping sound could be clearly heard on the empty moor. A jerk or two more, and he was finished. Stephen, forgetting that he had determined to hate all Englishmen, covered his face with his hands and wept. The gentleman danced round and sang to himself, as a child will when something has pleased it particularly. And when he was done, he said in a conversational tone,
"Ah, that was disappointing. He did not struggle at all. I wonder who he was."
"I told you, sir," said Stephen, wiping his eyes. "He is the man who told me that prophecy. He has a strange disfiguration upon his body, like writing." The gentleman pulled off Vinculus's coat, shirt, and neckcloth.
"Yes, there it is," he said in mild surprise.
He scratched with one nail at a little circle on Vinculus's right shoulder to see if it would come off. Finding it did not, he lost interest.
"Now," he said, "let us go and cast a spell upon Lady Pole."
"A spell, sir," said Stephen. "But why would we wish to do that?"
"Oh, so that she would die within a month or two. It is, apart from anything else, very traditional. It is very rare that anyone released from an enchantment is permitted to live long. Certainly not if I have enchanted them. Lady Pole is not far away, and the magicians must be taught that they may not oppose us with impunity. Come, Stephen."
Chapter 66. Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Mid-February, 1817. Mr. Norrell turned and looked back along the corridor which had once led from the library to the rest of the house. If he had had any confidence that it could take him back to Lascelles and the servants, he would have gone down it. But he was quite certain that Strange's magic would simply return him to this spot. There was a sound from within the library, and he gave a start of terror. He waited, but no one appeared. After a moment, he realized that he knew what the sound was. He had heard it 1,000 times before. It was the sound of Strange exclaiming in exasperation over some passage in a book. It was such a very familiar sound, and so closely connected in Mr. Norrell's mind with the happiest period of his existence, that it gave him the courage to open the door and go inside. The first thing that struck him was the immense quantity of candles. The room was full of light. Strange had not troubled to find candlesticks. He had simply stuck the candles to tables or to bookshelves. He had even stuck them to a pile of books. The library was in imminent danger of catching fire. There were books everywhere, scattered over tables, tumbled on the floor. Many had been laid face down on the floor, so that Strange should not lose his place. Strange was standing at the far end of the room. He was a much thinner person than Mr. Norrell remembered. He had shaved himself with no extraordinary degree of perfection, and his hair was ragged. He did not look up at Mr. Norrell's approach. "Seven people from Norwich in 1124, he said, reading from the book in his hand. "Four from Ayresgarth in Yorkshire at Christmas in 1151, 23 at Exeter in 1201, one from Hathersage in Derbyshire in 1243, all enchanted and stolen away into Faery. It was a problem he never solved." He spoke with such calm that Mr. Norrell, who was rather expecting to be blasted with a bolt of magic at any moment, looked round to see if someone else was in the room.
"I beg your pardon?" he asked.
"John Usklas," said Strange, still not troubling to turn around. "He could not prevent fairies stealing away Christian men and women. Why should I suppose that I might be capable of something he was not?" He read a little further.
"I like your labyrinth," he said conversationally. "Did you use Hickman?"
"What?"
"No, De Shep."
"De Shep? Really?
The first time Strange looked directly at his master. I had always supposed him to be a very minor scholar, without an original thought in his head.
He was never much to the taste of people who like the showier sorts of magic,
said Mr. Norrell, nervously, uncertain of how long this civil mood of Strange's might last.
He was interested in labyrinths, magical pathways, spells which may be affected by following certain steps and turns, things of that sort. There is a long description of his magic in Belisese's instructions.
He paused.
Which you've never seen. The only copy is here. It is on the third shelf by the window.
He pointed, and discovered that the shelf had been emptied.
Or it might be on the floor, he offered. In that pile.
I shall look in a moment, Strange assured him.
Your own labyrinth was quite remarkable, said Mr. Norrell. I've been half the night trying to escape it.
Oh, I did what I usually do in such circumstances, said Strange carelessly. I copied you and added some refinements.
How long has it been?
I beg your pardon?
How long have I been in the darkness?
Since the beginning of December.
And what month is it now?
February.
3 months, exclaimed Strange.
3 months. I thought it had been years. Mr. Norrell had imagined this conversation many times. Each time he had pictured Strange, angry and vengeful, and himself putting forth powerful arguments of self-justification. Now that they had finally met, Strange's unconcern was utterly bewildering. The distant pains Mr. Norrell had long felt in his small, shriveled soul awakened. They grew claws and rent at him. His hands began to shake.
I have been your enemy, he burst out. I destroyed your book, all except my own copy. I have slandered your name and plotted against you. The Cells and Drawlight have told everyone that you murdered your wife. I've let them believe it.
Yes, said Strange.
But these are terrible crimes. Why are you not angry?
Strange seemed to concede that this was a reasonable question. He thought for a moment.
I suppose it is because I've been many things since we last met. I have been trees and rivers and hills and stones. I've spoken to stars and earth and wind. One cannot be the conduit through which all English magic flows and still be oneself. I would have been angry, you say.
Mr. Norrell nodded. Strange smiled his old ironic smile. Then be comforted. I dare say I shall be so again. In time.
And you have done all this just to thwart me?
Asked Mr. Norrell.
To thwart you? Said Strange in astonishment. No, I have done this to save my wife.
There was a short silence during which Mr. Norrell found it impossible to meet Strange's eye.
What do you want from me?
He asked in a low voice.
Only what I've always wanted. Your help.
To break the enchantments?
Yes.
Mr. Norrell considered this for a moment.
The 100th anniversary of an enchantment is often most auspicious, he said. There are several rites and procedures.
Thank you, said Strange, with more than a tinge of his old sarcastic manner. But I believe I was hoping for something a little more immediate in its effect.
The death of the enchanter puts an end to all such contracts and enchantments, but—
Ah, yes, quite, interrupted Strange eagerly. The death of the enchanter. I thought of it often in Venice. With all of English magic at my disposal, there were so many ways I could have killed him. Sent him hurtling down from great heights, burned him with bolts of lightning, raised up mountains and crushed him beneath them. Had it been my freedom at stake, I would have certainly attempted it. But it was not my freedom. It was Arabella's. And if I had tried and failed, if I'd been killed, then her fate would have been sealed forever. So I set to thinking some more, and I thought how there was one man in all the world, in all the worlds that ever were, who would know how to defeat my enemy. One man who could advise me what I ought to do. I realized the time had come to speak to him.
Mr. Norrell looked more alarmed than ever.
Oh, but I must tell you that I no longer regard myself as your superior. My reading has been a great deal more extensive than yours, it is true, and I will give you what help I can, but I can offer you no security that I will be any more successful than you.
Strange frowned.
What? What are you talking about? I do not mean you. I mean John Usglas. I want your help in summoning John Usglas.
Mr. Norrell breathed hard. The very air seemed to quiver as if a deep note had been sounded. He was aware to an almost painful degree of the darkness surrounding them, of the new stars above them, and of the silence of the stopped clocks. It was one great black moment, going on forever, pressing down upon him, suffocating him. And in that moment, it cost no effort to believe that John Usglas was near, a mere spell away. The deep shadows in the far corners of the room were the folds of his robe. The smoke from the guttering candles was the raven mantling of his helm. Strange, however, seemed oppressed by no such immortal fears. He leant forward a little with an eager half-smile.
"Come, Mr. Norrell," he whispered.
"It is very dull working for Lord Liverpool. You must feel it so. Let other magicians cast protection spells over cliffs and beaches. There will be plenty of them to do it soon. Let you and me do something extraordinary." Another silence.
"You are afraid?" said Strange, drawing back displeased.
"Afraid?" burst out Norrell. "Of course I am afraid. It would be madness, absolute madness, to be anything else. But that is not my objection. It will not work. Whatever you hope to gain by it, it will not work. Even if we succeeded in bringing him forth, which we might very well do, you and I together, he will not help you in the way you imagine. Kings do not satisfy idle curiosity, this king least of all."
"You call it idle curiosity," began Strange.
No, said Norrell, interrupting hastily. "I do not. I merely represent to you how it will appear to him. What will he care about two lost women? You're thinking of John Usglas as if he were an ordinary man. I mean, a man like you or me. He was brought up and educated in faery. The ways of the Brugh were natural to him, and most Brughs contain captive Christians. He was one himself. It will not seem so extraordinary to him. He will not understand."
"Then I will explain it to him, Mr. Norrell.
I have changed England to save my wife. I have changed the world. I shall not flinch from summoning up one man. Let him be as tremendous as he may. Come, sir. There is very little sense in arguing about it. The first thing is to bring him here."
"How do we begin?"
Mr. Norrell sighed.
"It is not like summoning anyone else. There are difficulties peculiar to any magic involving John Usglas."
"Such as?"
"Well, for one thing, we do not know what to call him. Spells of summoning require the magician to be most particular about names. None of the names by which we call John Usglas were really his own. He was, as the histories tell, stolen away into faery before he could be christened, and so he became the nameless child in the Brugh. The nameless slave was one of the ways in which he referred to himself. Of course, the fairies gave him a name after their own fashion, but he cast that off when he returned to England. As for all his titles, the Raven King, the Black King, the King of the North, these are what other people called him, not what he called himself."
"Yes, yes," declared Strange impatiently. "I know all that. But surely John Usglas was his true name?"
"Oh, by no means. That was the name of a young Norman aristocrat who died, I believe, in the summer of 1097. The king, our John Usglas, claimed that man as his father, but many people have disputed whether they were really related at all. I do not suppose that this muddle of names and titles is accidental. The king knew that he would always draw the eyes of other magicians to him, and so he protected himself from the nuisance of their magic by deliberately confusing their spells."
"So what ought I to do?" Strange snapped his fingers. "Advise me." Mr. Norrell blinked his small eyes. He was unaccustomed to think so rapidly.
"If we use an ordinary English spell of summoning, and I strongly advise that we do, as they cannot be bettered, then we can make the elements of the spell do the work of identification for us. We will need an envoy, a path, and a Hansel."
Footnote 1. These are the customary three elements of a traditional English summoning spell. The envoy finds the person summoned, the path brings him to the summoner, and the Hansel, or gift, binds him to come.
If we choose the tools that already know the king and know him well,
then it will not matter that we cannot name him properly. They will find him, bring him, and bind him without our help. Do you see?
In spite of all his terror, he was growing more animated at the prospect of magic, new magic, to be performed with Mr. Strange. No, said Strange. I do not see at all.
This house is built upon the king's land, with stones from the king's abbey. A river runs by it, not more than 200 yards from this room. That river has often borne the king in his royal barge upon its waters. In my kitchen garden are a pear tree and an apple tree, the direct descendants of some pips spat out by the king when he sat one summer's evening in the abbot's garden. Let the old abbey stones be our envoy. Let the river be our path. Let next year's apples and pears from those trees be our handsel. Then we may name him simply the king. These stones, this river, those trees, know none other.
Good, said Strange. And what spell do you recommend? Are there any in Belisys?
Yes, 3.
Are they worth trying?
No, not really.
Mr. Norrell opened a drawer and drew out a piece of paper.
This is the best I know. I'm not in the habit of using summoning spells. But if I were, this is the one I would use.
He passed it to Strange. It was covered with Mr. Norrell's small, meticulous handwriting. At the top was written, Mr. Strange's Spell of Summoning.
It is the one you use to summon Maria Absalom.
Footnote 2. At the Shadow House in July 1809, Mr. Segundus, Mr. Honeyfoot and Henry Woodhope being present. Explained Norrell.
I've made some amendments. I have omitted the Flore Legium, which you copied word for word from Ormskirk. I have, as you know, no opinion of Flore Legia in general, and this one seems particularly nonsensical. I've added an epitome of preservation and deliverance, and a skimmer of supplication, though I doubt that either will help us much in this case.
Footnote 3. Flore Legium, epitome, and skimmer are all terms for parts of spells. In the 13th and 14th centuries, fairies in England were fond of adding to their magic exhortations to random collections of Christian saints. Fairies were baffled by Christian doctrine, but they were greatly attracted to saints, whom they saw as powerful magical beings whose patronage it was useful to have. These exhortations were called Flore Legia, cullings or gatherings of flowers, and fairies taught them to their Christian masters. When the Protestant religion took hold in England and saints fell out of favour, Flore Legia degenerated into meaningless collections of magical words and bits of other spells thrown in by the magician in the hope that some of them might take effect. An epitome is a highly condensed form of a spell inserted within another spell to strengthen or enlarge it. In this case, an epitome of preservation and deliverance is intended to protect the magician from the person summoned. A skimmer is a sprinkling of words or charms, from a dialect word of Northern English meaning to brighten or sparkle. A skimmer of supplication encourages the person summoned to aid the magician.
It is as much your work as mine now, observed Strange. There was no trace of rivalry or resentment in his voice.
No, no, said Norrell. All the fabric of it is yours. I've merely neatened the edges.
Good. Then we are ready, are we not?
There is one more thing.
What is it?
There are certain precautions that are necessary to secure Mrs. Strange's safety, explained Mr. Norrell.
Strange cast a glance at him, as if he thought it a little late in the day for Mr. Norrell to be thinking of Arabella's safety. But Mr. Norrell had hurried to a bookshelf and was busy delving in a large volume and did not notice.
The spell is written in Chasten's Liber Novus. Ah, yes, here it is. We must build a magical road and make a door so that Mrs. Strange may come safely out of Fairy. Otherwise she might be trapped there forever. It might take us centuries to find her.
Oh, that, said Strange. I've done it already, and appointed a doorkeeper to meet her when she comes out. All is in readiness.
He took the merest stub of a candle, placed it in a candlestick, and lit it. Footnote 4. The last element of a successful summoning spell is temporal. The magician must somehow convey to the summoned person when he is meant to appear. Otherwise, as Strange once observed, the summoned person might appear at any time and feel he has fulfilled his obligations. A candle stub is a very convenient device. The magician instructs the person summoned to appear when the flame goes out. Then he began to recite the spell. He named the Abbey Stones as the envoy sent to seek the king. He named the river as the path the king was to come. He named next year's apples and pears from Mr. Norrell's trees as the handsel the king was to receive. He named the moment of the flames dying as the time when the king was to appear. The candle guttered and went out. And in that moment, the room was full of ravens. Black wings filled the air like great hands gesturing, filled Strange's vision like a tumult of black flames. He was struck at from every side by wings and claws. The cawing and the croaking were deafening. Ravens battered walls, battered windows, battered Strange himself. He covered his head with his hands and fell to the floor. The din and strife of wings continued a little while longer. Then, in the blink of an eye, they were gone, and the room was silent. The candles had all been extinguished. Strange rolled onto his back, but for some moments he could do nothing but stare into the darkness. "Mr. Norrell?" he said at last. No one answered. In the pitch-black darkness, he got to his feet. He succeeded in finding one of the library desks, and felt about until his hand met with an upturned candle. He took his tinderbox from his pocket and lit it. Raising it above his head, he saw that the room was in the last extremes of chaos and disorder. Not a book remained upon a shelf. Tables and library steps had been overturned. Several fine chairs had been reduced to firewood. A thick drift of raven feathers covered everything, as if a black snow had fallen. Norrell was half lying, half sitting on the floor, his back against a desk. His eyes were open, but blank-looking. Strange passed the candle before his face. "Mr. Norrell," he said again. In a dazed whisper, Norrell said, "I believe we may assume that we have his attention." "I believe you are right, sir. Do you know what happened?" Still in a whisper, Norrell said,
"The books all turned into ravens. I had my eye upon Hugh Pontifex's The Fountain of the Heart, and I saw it change. He used it often, you know, that chaos of blackbirds. I've been reading about it since I was a boy. That I should live to see it, Mr. Strange, that I should live to see it. It has a name in the Sidhe language, the language of his childhood, but the name is lost."
Footnote 5. The chaos of ravens and wind is also described in the tale of the Newcastle glovemaker's child, chapter 39, footnote 1. He suddenly seized Strange's hands.
"Are the books safe?"
Strange picked up one from the floor. He shook the raven feathers off it and glanced at the title. 7 Doors and 42 Keys by Piers Roussinol. He opened it and began to read at random. "And there you will find a strange country like a chessboard, where alternates barren rock with fruitful orchards, wastes of thorns with fields of bearded corn, water meadows with deserts. And in this country, the god of magicians, thrice great Hermes, has set a guard upon every gate and every bridge. And in one place, a ram, in another place, serpent. Does that sound right?" he asked doubtfully. Mr. Norrell nodded. He took out his pocket handkerchief and dabbed the blood from his face with it. The two magicians sat upon the floor amid the books and feathers, and for a little while they said nothing at all. The world had shrunk to the breadth of a candle's light. Finally, Strange said, "How near to us must he be in order to do magic like that?"
"John Osglas, for aught I know, he can do magic like that from 100 worlds away, from the heart of hell. Still, it is worth trying to find out, is it not?"
"Is it?" asked Norrell.
"Well, for example, if we found he was close by, we could..."
Strange considered a moment.
"We could go to him."
"Very well," sighed Norrell.
He did not sound or look very hopeful. The first, and indeed only, requirement for spells of location is a silver dish of water. At Hurtview Abbey, Mr. Norrell's dish had stood upon a little table in the corner of the room, but the table had been destroyed by the violence of the ravens, and the dish was nowhere to be seen. They searched for a while, and eventually found it in the fireplace, upside down beneath a mess of raven feathers and damp, torn pages from books.
"We need water," said Norrell. "I always made Lucas get it from the river, a water that has travelled rapidly is best for location magic, and Hurtview's river is quick-flowing even in summer.
I will fetch it.
But Mr. Norrell was not much in the habit of doing anything for himself, and it was a little while before he was out of the house. He stood on the lawn and stared up at stars he had never seen before. He did not feel as if he were inside a pillar of darkness in the middle of Yorkshire. He felt more as if the rest of the world had fallen away, and he and Strange were left alone upon a solitary island or promontory. The idea distressed him a great deal less than one might have supposed. He had never much cared for the world, and bore its loss philosophically. At the river's edge, he knelt down among the frozen grasses to fill the dish with water. The unknown stars shone up at him from the depths. He stood up again, a little dizzy from the unaccustomed exertion, and immediately he had an overwhelming sense of magic going on, much stronger than he had ever felt it before. If anyone had asked him to describe what was happening, he would have said that all of Yorkshire was turning itself inside out. For a moment, he could not think which direction the house lay in. He turned, stumbled, and walked straight into Mr. Strange, who for some reason was standing directly behind him.
I thought you were going to remain in the library, he said in surprise.
Strange glared at him. I did remain in the library. One moment I was reading Gourbet's Gatekeeper of Apollo. The next moment, I was here.
You did not follow me? Asked Norrell.
No, of course not. What is happening? And what in God's name is taking you so long?
I could not find my greatcoat, said Norrell humbly. I did not know where Lucas had put it.
Strange raised one eyebrow, sighed, and said, I presume you experienced the same as me. Just before I was plucked up and brought here, there was a sensation like winds and waters and flames all mixed together.
Yes, said Norrell.
And a faint odor, as of wild herbs and mountainsides?
Yes, said Norrell.
Fairy magic?
Oh, said Norrell, undoubtedly. This is part of the same spell that keeps you here in eternal darkness.
He looked around.
How extensive is it?
What?
The darkness.
Well, it is hard for me to know exactly, since it moves around with me. But other people have told me that it is the size of the parish in Venice where I lived, say, half an acre.
Half an acre? Stay here.
Mr. Norrell put the silver dish of water down upon the frozen ground. He walked off in the direction of the bridge. Soon, all that was visible of him was his grey wig. In the starlight, it resembled nothing so much as a little stone tortoise waddling away. The world gave another twist. And suddenly, the two magicians were standing together on the bridge over the river at Hertview.
What in the world? Began Strange. You see, said Norrell grimly, the spell will not allow us to move too far from one another. It has gripped me too. I dare say there was some regrettable impreciseness in the fairy's magic. He has been careless. I dare say he named you as the English magician, or some such vague term. Consequently, his spell, meant only for you, now entraps any English magician who stumbles into it.
Ah, said Strange. He said nothing more. There did not seem anything to say. Mr. Norrell turned towards the house.
If nothing else, Mr. Strange, he said, this is an excellent illustration of the need for great preciseness about names and spells.
Behind him, Strange raised his eyes heavenward. In the library, they placed the silver dish of water on a table between them. It was very odd, but the discovery that he was now imprisoned in eternal darkness with Strange seemed to have raised Mr. Norrell's spirits rather than otherwise. Cheerfully, he reminded Strange that they still had not found a way to name John Usglask, and that this was certain to be a great obstacle in finding him, by magic or any other means. Strange, with his head propped upon his hands, stared at him gloomily. Just try John Usglask, he said. So Norrell did the magic, naming John Usglas as the person they sought. He divided the surface of the water into quarters with lines of glittering light. He gave each quarter a name, heaven, hell, earth, and fairy. Instantly, a speck of bluish light shone in the quarter that represented earth. There, said Strange, leaping up triumphantly. You see, sir, things are not always as difficult as you suppose. Norrell tapped the surface of the quarter. The divisions disappeared. He redrew them, naming them afresh, England, Scotland, Ireland, elsewhere. The speck of light appeared in England. He tapped the quarter, redrew the divisions, and examined the result, and on he went, refining the magic. The speck glowed steadily. He made a soft sound of exclamation.
"What is it?" asked Strange. In a tone of wonder, Narl said, "I think we may have succeeded after all. It says he is here, in Yorkshire."
Chapter 67 The Hawthorn Tree, February 1817. Childermas was crossing a lonely moorland. In the middle of the moor, a misshapen hawthorn tree stood all alone, and from the tree, a man was hanging. He had been stripped of his coat and shirt, revealing in death what had doubtless been kept hidden during his life, that his skin bore a strange deformation. His chest, back, and arms were covered with intricate blue marks, marks so dense that it was more blue than white. As he rode up to the tree, Childermas wondered if the murderer had written upon the body as a joke. When he had been a sailor, he had heard tales of countries where criminals' confessions were written on to their bodies by various horrible means before they were killed. From a distance, the marks looked very like writing, but as he got closer, he saw that they were beneath the skin. He got down from his horse and swung the body round until it was facing him. The face was purple and swollen. The eyes were bulging and filled with blood. He studied it until he could discern in the distorted features a face he knew. "Venculus," he said. Taking out his pocket knife, he cut the body down. Then he pulled off Vinculus's breeches and boots and surveyed the body, the corpse of a forked animal on a barren winter moor. Strange marks covered every inch of his skin. The only exceptions were his face, hands, private parts, and the soles of his feet. He looked like a blue man wearing white gloves and a white mask. The more Childermas looked at him, the more he felt that the marks meant something. "This is the king's letters," he said at last. "This is Robert Findhelm's book." Just then it started to snow with a flurry of sharp, icy flakes. The wind blew harder. Childermas thought of Strange and Norrell 20 miles away, and he laughed out loud. What did it matter who read the books at Hurtview? The most precious book of all lay naked and dead in the snow and the wind. "So," he said, "it has fallen to me, has it? The greatest glory and the greatest burden given to any man in this age." At present, the burden was more obvious than the glory. The book was in a most inconvenient form. He had no idea how long Vinculus had been dead, or how soon he might begin to rot. What to do? He could take his chances and throw the body over his horse, but a freshly hanged corpse would be difficult to explain to anyone he met on the road. He could hide the body and go and fetch a horse and cart. How long would it take? And supposing that in the meantime someone found the body and took it? There were doctors in York who would pay money for corpses, and no questions asked. "I could cast a spell of concealment," he thought. A spell of concealment would certainly hide it from human eyes, but there were dogs, foxes, and crows to consider. They could not be deceived by any magic Childermas knew. The book had been eaten once already. He had no wish to risk it happening a second time. The obvious thing was to make a copy, but his memorandum book, pen, and ink were lying upon the table in the drawing room in the darkness of Hurtview Abbey. So what then? He could scratch a copy onto the frozen earth with a stick, but that was no better than what he had already. If only there had been some trees, he might have been able to strip the bark and burn some wood and write upon the bark with the ashes. But there was only this one twisted hawthorn. He looked at his pocket knife. Perhaps he ought to copy the book onto his own body. There were several things in favor of this plan. First, who was to say that the positioning upon Vinculus's body did not carry some meaning with it? The closer to the head, the more important the text. Anything was possible. Second, it would make the book both secret and secure. He would not have to worry about anyone stealing it. Whether he intended to show it to Strange or Norrell, he had not yet decided. But the writing upon Vinculus's body was both dense and intricate. Even if he was able to force his knife to mimic all those delicate dots, circles, and flourishes exactly, which he doubted, he would have to cut quite deep to make the marks permanent. He took off his greatcoat and his ordinary coat. He undid the wrists of his shirt and rolled up his sleeve. As an experiment, he cut one of the symbols on the inside of Vinculus's arm into the same place upon his own arm. The result was not promising. There was so much blood that it was difficult to see what he was doing, and the pain made him feel faint.
I can afford to lose some blood in this cause, but there is so much writing, it will surely kill me. Besides, how in the world could I copy what is written on his back? I'll put him over my horse, and if anyone challenges me, well, I'll fire at them if needs be. That is the plan. It's not a very good plan, but it is a plan. He put on his coat and his greatcoat again. Brewer had wandered off a little way and was cropping at some dry grasses which the wind had exposed. Childermas walked over to him. Out of the valise, he took a length of strong rope and the box containing his pistols. He rammed a ball into each pistol and primed them with powder.